Right, a guy came up to me recently after show and said, "Oh, you guys must have jungle fever," which I resent because it suggests that black people and white people can't be in a relationship together and there's a weird sexual fetish. We're married, like there's nothing sexual about it.
Hi, everybody. This is the Multiracial Family Man podcast. I'm Alex Barnett, your host. And as always, we'll be talking on the podcast about issues of relevance and concern to people who are multiracial and to people within multiracial families. Before we get to our guest for the podcast, I want to remind you that, as always, you can reach me on the web at www.alexbarnettcomic.com and on Twitter at @barnettcomic. On Facebook at facebook.com/AlexBarnettComic. And probably you can find me on LinkedIn and Pinterest if you want to find me there too. So without further ado, let's get to our guest for the podcast. Okay, folks, I want to welcome to the podcast a very, very special guest, a good friend of mine. And I say that sincerely, not like Johnny Carson, just say good friend of mine. I would bring on some like juggler who he didn't know. But this is a very good friend of mine who I've known for years and years now. Not too many years. She's not that old. I'm much older. But nevertheless, a good friend of mine who I've known quite some time, who is a very interesting person with an interesting background, very interesting personal story, and also who is doing some really intriguing and important work now that we're going to talk about. So without further ado, let me welcome to the podcast Shireen Crawford. Welcome, Shireen.
Hi, Alex. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for coming to the podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here with you.
Wow, excited. That's excellent. That's we love that enthusiasm on this podcast.
Good issues and good topics.
Yeah, I think so. Well, let's get right into it. I mean, this is an issue, or the issues that we focus on the podcast, multiracial families and multicultural, multiracial people. I mean, it's who you are, and that's why I was so excited to have you on as a guest. So let's get right into that, to your personal story and your personal background. I mean, for the people who are listening and can't see you, obviously, you are a biracial person, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so why don't you tell people a little bit about your background as much as you're comfortable telling us?
Sure. Right, it could take up way more than time we have, probably.
We'll do the Cliff Notes / Reader's Digest version.
Yeah, well, I'm a biracial person. I guess a significant part of my identity and background is the fact that I'm adopted. And so my birth father is, from what I know, African American, and my birth mother is a white Caucasian. And I was adopted when I was very young, a baby, 6 weeks old. So I was adopted and raised by my parents, who are both white. And I have two sisters that I grew up with. They're both white. They're both birth children of my parents who raised me. So, so there's a lot of different layers there. And then I have a third sister who I met, over 10 years ago now, who is the daughter, I guess my half-sister, or my birth mother's daughter that she had later after me. So, yeah, and she is actually Egyptian and white, so there's a lot of different...
Wow. I think you may win the prize for the most multi-layered, multiracial person that we've had on the podcast thus far. And I think
my brother-in-law has a Mexican heritage and married my sister. Do I get an extra bonus for that?
Yeah, I'd throw in an extra bonus for that. So I think you may hold the crown for some time as the champ of multiraciality. But let's I hate to use the word unpack, but let's go back and look at each of these different layers, because I think it's fascinating. So, because I've yet to interview someone on the show who's been adopted, and I think it's really an important issue, and it's an issue that certainly has gotten attention over the years, but I don't know that people focus on it as much as maybe they ought to in terms of transracial adoption. I mean, right. I think they only ever talk about it when Angelina Jolie adopts a kid from Africa, but but I don't know that people talk about it enough or as much when it comes to just ordinary people within America adopting other American babies.
Right.
So, at what point were you informed, or did you learn that you were adopted?
You know, I don't. There was never any big moment that stood out that was like, "You're adopted." It was just something that my mother always talked to me about. She was very open about it and discussing it with me and explaining it to me from a very young age, in a very accepting, loving way of, you know, you have a mother who gave birth to you, and I'm the mother who's raising you and loves you, and she wasn't able to take care of you. So, you know, and so it was always just kind of a part of, I guess, the story, you know, like people would tell their kids, like, when I went to the hospital and you were born, kind of stories. My story was a story about, you know, the day I came home with them from, you know, being adopted.
Okay. And let's also flesh in some details or fill in some details. I mean, first of all, your parents who raised you, may I tell where you were raised? I mean, is that, I don't want to give away too much private information.
Yeah, actually, I was born in Chicago.
Right.
And I primarily grew up in the Midwest, in Minnesota.
Right, which is a very white state.
Yes, it's pretty white and homogenous. And yeah, and most of my younger years were in northern Minnesota. So, it was a very interesting upbringing, you know. At the time, I think it just seemed difficult. Now, looking back, you're like, wow, you know, being really the only, you know, at that time, it just, you know, I guess I knew I was biracial, and that was part of my identity, but it was very much like, you're black in this very white place.
Right. I mean, for people who don't know, like, northern Minnesota, where Shireen was growing up, is basically Lutherans from Scandinavia who were transplanted 100 years ago to go work in the tundra, and it's all white, like all Lutheran. It's Fargo, basically. It's the characters from Fargo.
Close, but not quite. Yeah.
But working outdoors. And here you are. And so since people can't see you, we should describe. Like, Shireen, you're not, like, I wouldn't say you're extremely dark, but you're a visibly black person, or a visibly visible person of color.
Yes, I would never say that I could pass.
Right.
But and I guess my. Yeah, definitely. I think that's a fair description. Yeah.
Right. Right. So. You know, especially in a place like Minnesota, which is so white, any amount of color would just set you apart, I suppose. So now you're being raised by this white family in Minnesota in a very white environment, which has to be difficult, I'm sure. Which you've said already, it was.
Yeah, there are definitely challenges.
Yeah. Now, are you, of your sisters that you grew up with, are you the oldest?
I am the oldest of three girls, yeah.
Now, to what extent did that, at all affect your upbringing? I mean, did you feel like you were protective of your sisters? Did you feel like they were protective of you? Did the race issue come into play at all amongst the three sisters?
You know, I guess I was a typical oldest child, but we're all about 5 years apart. So, you know, we were all at very different stages in our life as we went through things. You know, when I was, you know, in high school, my younger sister is, you know, kind of just starting school and, getting there. And so, I can't say that. The one thing that stands out to me is the fact that it didn't really come up much in our family. And even when we were, my middle sister, who's 5 years younger than me, we were in Chicago and we were driving in the car, and I forget, she must have been maybe 3 or 4. And she was looking out the window and she turned to my parents and she said, "Mom, Shireen's black." So I guess for her, that was like some sort of like, you know, she had never even, you know, obviously had never even had crossed her mind or that she had thought about it. But, you know, we were in Chicago. She was seeing other black people out the window in the car, and something clicked for her there. So I guess, you know, it just never really was any kind of point between us.
Right. But she didn't say it like Shireen's black and therefore that means something in terms of a value judgment. She just did it as an observation.
Yeah, it was purely an observation that she hadn't, you know, made before.
Right, because I will say that my son, who's even younger than your sister was during this story, my son who's 3, has noted or observed verbally that my wife is black. You know, it's been at home. He said, "Mommy's black and Daddy's white." And then he said, "I'm white," meaning him. And and my son is very light. So, I mean, you could see why he would say that. But, you know, you always wonder. And he can't really articulate it now because he's still pretty young, but whether he's just noting that as an observation or whether he's ascribing some sort of value judgment that he's learned even at such a young age. And there's no way for us to know right now.
Right. But I think that our society, right, is just very much, once you start making those observations, everything around you is kind of feeding you things to attach a value to it. To race, to color, to shade, you know, to all the different features of people. Like, even, like you're talking about your son, like, I don't have children, but once in a while when I watch cartoons or TV, some things are just so obviously sending them these messages early on.
Well, yeah.
And so whether they even know the value is being attached or not, it is. It, you know, at least that's what it feels like.
Well, so, I mean, yeah, and I'm older than you, and I can remember watching things like Bugs Bunny when I was a kid. And in those days, they used to run the old Bugs Bunnies from even before I was, you know, born, you know, from the 40s and 50s when they had, you know, overtly racist cartoons. Because that was what was generally accepted in society. So they'd have, like, the Black Crows would be these stand-ins, you know, anthropomorphic characters for black people, and they would do stuff that was stereotypically quote-unquote black and talk quote-unquote black accents. And so I'm watching this as a 4 and 5 and 6-year-old, and who knows what kind of effects that's having on my brain and my socialization.
It impresses upon you very young without you even knowing it's happening.
Right. So my son, who watches just tons of cartoons, although mostly Curious George, so I'm not sure what.
We won't say anything about your parenting.
Yeah, that's right. We won't say anything about that. But all right, so let's go back to your story because so your sister has this observation, but generally speaking, within your family, race obviously was not an issue because, you know, it was just about raising you and your sisters, and everyone got along. Now, were there other children of color in the school districts or schools that you went to at the time?
You could count them on one hand. I mean, in the area where we lived, there was a fairly significant Native American community, which is always interesting because I felt like more of the kind of overt racism and discrimination was directed towards them as a group versus the, you know, 1 or 2 African American people who were there. But it was very small numbers as far as, you know, being able to look around and see other people who look like me.
Yeah. Now, did you and the Native Americans or the other couple of black kids, did you guys make common cause? Did you create alliances amongst yourselves? Or did you sort of maintain yourselves as islands unto yourselves?
I think it ebbed and flowed. I think at different points there would be some unity, as far as the, you know, African American kids, our numbers were just so small that, you know, I think we kind of, you know, went between, you know.
Yeah.
And I have to say, like, the other, you know, the other actually two that really stand out to me, African-American boys in my school, they also were biracial. I think their father was black and their mother was white. And so, you know, but our experience was kind of this black experience, but yet, you know, we all had this biracial background.
Yeah. Now, as you got older and got into high school and discovered, you know, puberty and dating and all that stuff, how did that play out? Because I've talked to other biracial people, and particularly biracial women, where that becomes a very awkward, even more awkward phase of life than it ordinarily is for everybody, because there's this racial overlay where biracial girls feel like they can't date white guys, and then the black guys don't want to date them either, and then it's sort of stuck in the middle. Did you have a similar experience, or what was your experience?
Yeah, I guess in the whole dating thing, a lot of different things happened. I remember those very young times when you're first starting to notice boys and they're noticing you and all that. And I guess it must have been like maybe sixth or seventh grade or something around there. I'm not always good with time frames exactly, but... there was a boy I liked, and he liked me, and he just told me, he's like, I can't go out with you, whatever that was in seventh grade, because my dad would be really mad. My dad would be upset. I think, you know, I didn't really know what to do with that, but obviously a certain amount of shame attached to it, and that, wow, like, this person who likes me can't really show that or, you know, put it out in the world because there'll be some sort of consequence. So that, you know, it's a pretty powerful message.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that has carried forward in your life in terms of your dating life or your relationship life?
I don't think it, as far as making of choices, but just more of a consciousness, of being kind of alert in choosing partners and who you date, and that as you get older and you really kind of look at more long-term and invested relationships, all that comes with that is people's family and friends. And although someone may really be a good partner for you, if you take them as a whole, you may be taking on all these other challenges of, you know, the issues of race with people who will not accept you for who you are. And so kind of factoring that into, you know, more serious or long-term relationships.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Okay. Now, do you think there were, or I should ask this way, were there any episodes when you were growing up, say between 0 and 17, when you got out of high school, that really left an impression, good or bad, that left you feeling like, you know, I live in a great community and I want to stay here. Oh my God, I got to get the hell out of here. And I'm particularly asking in the context of race.
Just any experiences?
Well, in other words, were there any experiences that left you feeling like my community is so accepting and this is a great place for a person of color to live, notwithstanding the fact that there's no black people, or something like, you know, where they had a Klan rally on your front lawn, you thought like, I got to get out of here as soon as I can get in a car and drive.
I think for me, all through high school was, I have to get the hell out of here as soon as possible.
But is that because you were Kevin Bacon and this is Footloose and you were trying to get out of the small town?
I think there was some of that, but some of getting out of the small town for me was getting out to somewhere that I felt accepted and safe and like I could be myself, and I just didn't see a lot of that reflected around me. Albeit my parents, you know, extremely loving people and did everything they could, or that they knew how, I guess I should say, to try to create an environment and opportunities for me to, you know, meet other adopted people, meet other biracial people, meet other people of color, you know, traveling, you know, their circle of friends, you know, buying me dolls that look like me, you know, things like that, books, storybooks, and all those things. But at the same time, I very much was like, you know, I can't, you know, I don't see reflections of myself in my everyday life.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's always the, like the little, and not little things, like it's a huge thing, but you know, as, you know, a woman of color, you have no place to do your, get your hair done, you know?
Which is a big deal. I mean, as a guy, married,
a huge deal.
As a guy married to a woman of color, a black woman who has an Afro and who transferred from straightened hair to an Afro when we were together, I can vouch for the fact that black women's hair, women of color's hair, is a big, big, big deal.
It is. It's huge. And one of the things that, you know, I tell my friends who are now
like a big
having
deal.
Children, it's huge. It's huge. Like, yeah. I have friends who are having biracial babies and friends who are adopting babies. And I end up telling them the story about, you know, one of my friends, he's white, his wife is black, and he's like, what if I have a girl? How am I going to deal with her hair? And I said, you're going to do everything you can to make sure that she has access to however she wants to wear or needs to wear her hair. You know, you are going to support that fully. And, you know, giving him all kinds of, you know, suggestions. I said, you know, my father would drive from where we lived in northern Minneapolis, northern Minnesota, to Minneapolis, which was about a 3.5-4 hour drive, to go to the salon, excuse me, in North Minneapolis and sit there and read the paper in a, you know, black salon while I got my hair done, you know.
Oh, this is great. Because, that, your dad is a hero. I mean, your dad is a hero. I have this vision of him taking you there, and then, like, somehow you get out of the car and you see a young Prince, you know, while he's tuning up his guitar and playing on the street still because he hasn't been discovered.
Exactly.
all right. So your dad's a hero. Now, I do take it from what you've told me, you know, offline in the past and now tonight, that your folks were obviously very progressive, but perhaps even a bit hippie-ish. Like, were they hippies?
No, I wouldn't say they were hippies. I mean, maybe some people would, I don't know. I wouldn't describe them as hippies, but they're just very kind of absolutely loving and accepting of everyone in a way that is just, you know, kind of unbelievable at times.
Well, let me ask you this. Does your father in the summertime wear Birkenstock sandals with white socks?
No, he didn't, because then I would have to walk away.
Because that would be an interesting...
Couldn't walk around with him.
That would be an interesting dichotomy to have a black daughter with a white father who wears Birkenstocks with white socks. So I've never seen a black guy do that in my life.
That's true. I don't think I've seen that either.
Right. So I think that would have been an interesting life experience for you. All right. So you get out of high school. You decide to move away. And now college, you went to the University of Minnesota, correct?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Did you go in Minneapolis?
I lived in Minneapolis, yes.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming at that point there were introduced into your life far more people of color.
I was, and that was exciting, and, you know, I went through a whole kind of, I don't know, like, being black. I think it was the white part of me, you know, the younger years, and then it was like, I want, you know, I was in the black student union, and I wanted to study the Black Panthers, and I wanted to, you know, just kind of embrace and immerse in this whole other, you know, kind of side that had been very limited and not very accessible to me. So that was exciting, you know, and also then there's that dating thing too, right?
There's... Right. Well, let me ask you first about the first part of that answer. Do you think that your experience, I mean, obviously you can't know this for sure, but do you suspect that your experience is alike to many biracial kids, particularly those who are raised in neighborhoods or communities that are maybe more white, that at some point they really seek out the black part of their identity and perhaps immerse themselves to the point of saturation in black history and black culture and so on and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's experience is different, and it depends on, you know, your individual, like what part of the country you're in, where your parents' perspective, which parent or both parents you're raised by. You know, it's funny you say that because I'm thinking of my husband, who's also biracial.
Yes, and by the way, for the people who are listening, I just because they can't see you, And I know Shireen's going to get mad at me, but I'm saying anyway. Shireen resembles, in many, many ways, Alicia Keys. And,
oh, wow.
And her husband looks a lot like Common. So it's very funny to see them together because when I'm out with them, which is not that often anymore because I have a child, but when we used to go out from time to time, I always felt like I was amongst celebrities because Alicia Keys and Common would be accompanying me to a restaurant. And it was really a thrill for me, in sort of once removed. But in any event,
you're very funny.
my wife doesn't think so, but anyway. So you were saying your husband is biracial as well.
Yeah, and I guess you're asking about the experience of kind of going off to school. Well, he was raised by his black father, but I guess I can't really speak for him, but you know, some of the things he shared with me is sort of tapping into a lot of those things in college too. So I don't know if it's everyone's experience, but I think people who are wanting to and seeking to figure out their identity and what it all means and how it all fits together for them probably does have kind of like these different extremes and explorations to figure it out for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Now talk about what I'm really interested about is your experience, you know, because in a way it's analogous to my experience with my son, and I'll say it this way. As a black woman or a woman of color, you know, your mother's white. So The question becomes, is there a disconnect or a discordance when the person of your gender, the parent of your gender, is the different color? Like, my son's biracial, and to many people in America, that means he's black. I'm a white man. I often think about later in life when, you know, he's more of a man or a young adult, whether he'll have experiences that I can't help him with because I've never experienced them myself. For example, you know, all the stuff with the cops that's going on now. I'm not saying my son's going to have an issue with the cops, but, you know, that's potentially out there, whether he may be challenged because of his color. And that's something that I can't, you know, directly relate to. So did you have that kind of experience with your mother? Because she's white and you're a person of color, and maybe the dynamic for women in the world is different whether you're black or white.
Yeah, sure. I think very much so. And I think it still happens till today. You know, we have, conversations about current events, and, you know, we got into it about the Oscars, and then we had to kind of like agree to disagree. And we both took kind of unsuspecting stances for her being white and me being, you know, a person of color. But I think that is always, you know, has always been an issue, is that, you know, both my parents, you know, can kind of sympathize when I share experiences or things or concerns or, bad things that have happened. But they can't really understand what it's like to face and the type of, like, you know, racism or sexism combined, that I have. And one thing that always makes me think of that is when I was elementary school, someone they called me nigger and probably some other things. And I went home and told my dad, and then my dad marched down to the school and talked to the principal. And at the time, I just didn't even think about it, but in retrospect, as you know, over the years, like, here's my white dad going down and talking to, you know, the white principal.
Right.
Where if that was my black father, I mean, maybe we would have had that talk before that happened. Maybe, you know, or my mother, my black mother, maybe it just would have been more of a conversation in our household. Maybe I would have seen my parents go through it and saw how they dealt with it, or my siblings. So, you know, I think there's many things that that are challenging in that way, and not impossible, and not, like, you know, can't be addressed in some way. But, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. I raise it because I recently talked to a woman, actually, Tiffany Jones, who was on the podcast not long back, who is biracial herself, but her parents... her father's white and her mother's black. And she said that as a biracial person, you know, it was, she thought that the growing up as a female, your experience would be changed fairly dramatically in her estimation, depending on whether your mother is black or whether your mother is white, because are you learning femininity and womanhood from a person who comes from the race that is the oppressor or the oppressed? Now, that's a theory. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you'd ever resolve or come to a conclusion about that, but I thought it was an interesting insight, and that's sort of what I was asking you, whether you thought that that had some impact on your development as a woman, that you, that your female role model was a white woman versus a black woman.
Yeah, I can't say that. I think, you know, it's actually an interesting question because I've never really critically, like, examined that too much. Because I feel like there's a lot of core, you know, values as a woman and just as a person that I've gotten from my mother, regardless of race. And I don't know that, like, kind of this idea of, like, the oppressor or the oppressed, you know, without, maybe, yeah, it's like you have nothing else to compare it to. And so it's, I feel like speculation if it would have influenced me, you know, as a person, like even being an adoptive person, you ask the question, like, if I was raised by my birth mother versus my adoptive mother, like, would that
right.
change things?
Right,
know?
Right. Well, obviously it would have, but there's no way of knowing how.
So would it change you at your core as a person and how you kind of adopt your values and personhood and womanhood?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Now we're really getting into philosophical territory, which is above my pay grade. Well, okay, look, we're getting into some pretty serious stuff, which is good. But on the other hand, you know, the listeners expect me to be funny sometimes. So let me ask you a more lighthearted question.
Okay.
And it still goes to the question of race. I mean, as a person of color growing up and where you did and how you did, I'm curious whether as a preteen and teen, whether you're heartthrobs and teen crushes were white guys or black guys? Like, you know, was it Mario Lopez from Saved by the Bell? Or was it, you know, well, I'm using references from when I was a kid, but like, so they're completely out of date, but like Rick Springfield from General Hospital or...
I think I was equal opportunity. I mean, I was definitely into like, let's date my age, right? Like Corey Haim and Corey Feldman and those guys.
Uh-huh. What about John Stamos?
Huge... No. That might have been my sister. But I was also a huge, I guess everyone was, but I was huge Michael Jackson fan.
Yeah, but that's not a sexual thing. That's not like a crush thing. That's just like, right? I mean, I assume not.
I don't know. I mean, I had the poster like above my bed, like on ceiling.
Shereen, listen, I have a lot of respect for you, so don't crush that by telling me that you had like, you know, prepubescent sexual feelings for Michael Jackson.
But I mean, I think it was, you know, I tried to. Gosh, that's to like dig back to
For Prince,
childhood
yes.
crushes.
If you said Prince, then I'd be like, okay, because that guy, you know, looks like he.
Well, yeah. Prince too, but that was, you know.
I mean, Prince oozes sexuality. Michael Jackson oozes like zaniness. I mean, God, you know, rest in peace. So, I mean, look, like when I was a kid, I'm older than you. Considerably. I feel like I'm 1,000 right now, but like when I was growing up, the big, you know, for guys, it was always like, you know, Cheryl Ladd and Farrah Fawcett and Cheryl Teagues, and then Carol Alt, who, by the way, went to my high school, which is a, you know, I feel like I'm almost famous by in transitive property. And then some of these Sports Illustrated models. But, you know,
you have a much better memory than I do.
Well, but it's interesting because when I was a kid in the, I guess, you know, late 70s, early 80s, into the mid 80s, you know, where I grew up, which was almost entirely white, you know, there was no crossover. There were no like black models or starlets who were, I think, looked upon with goo-goo eyes by white guys in my neighborhood.
At least
that I'm aware of. So that's sort of interesting. That's why I was sort of asking you about that. Also, just funny to see who people, you know, had dreamy eyes about. So, all right. So you finish at Minnesota, University of Minnesota. Go Gophers. And then did you stay on at all for any post-grad studies or anything like that?
After I graduated from college, I worked for a bit in Minnesota. And then I moved to New York, I guess, about two years after I graduated from college.
Now, was that by design because you had some career aspiration or something, or you wanted to be an actress, or because you were chasing a boy, or?
I guess I needed to find home. It was no grand design. It was I had been visiting New York for a few years and had friends here and really just fell in love with the city and knew that I felt like Minnesota and my life there had run its course. And I wanted to go to law school and I wanted to be in some place that I could have that
right
opportunity.
And there's just so much ice fishing you can do. So,
right. Exactly. I actually thought it would be a little warmer in New York. I don't know why, but it's not.
Well, as this winter shows us, yeah. Okay, so you come to New York with this vague notion, perhaps, of going to law school, which was obviously a colossal mistake. But so you come here, and that's where the story brings us together.
Right.
Shortly thereafter, because at the time, you were working with my mother.
That's right. I was working shortly after 9/11, and I got a job working with the YWCA, yeah, helping people get work, helping people get jobs.
Right. Now, what did my mother do there? Did she actually do work?
She did, and she was very sweet and kind, and she worked very hard.
Really? Because, I mean, my mom, I love my mom more than anything, but I tell you, she never struck me as somebody who, like, really loved working.
Wow, I hope she doesn't listen to your podcast.
No, she does. I said that for her benefit because she listens. I'm sure she'll critique me. I said that for her benefit. No, she's a very hard worker, and I'm not surprised to hear that she was, you know, very kind and generous and sincere. But so I remember I came to visit her once at work, and you happened to be there. We got to talking, and I didn't realize at the time, I guess, that you had just moved from Minnesota not long before that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It was a new transplant back then.
Yeah, yeah. So now let's fast forward a couple of years, and then you wind up at law school in New York City. And, you know, Sharina did a hard way because you went at night for a while, or for the whole time, or for a while?
Yeah, I went. Well, I was in law school. I worked full-time for the mayor's office and went to school at night for 4 years and
which
got
is,
my law degree.
Yeah, which is, if anybody knows law school, that's a real challenge. And then you got out, and you went to work for the Manhattan DA.
That's right.
Yeah. And tell us about that, because I think that's where I want to get into your careers part for this, you know, final quarter of the show, but or final third of the show. But, you know, that really was a for lack of a better term, like a seminal experience for you, right? Because I'll let you tell the story, but one of the themes is that you saw a lot of people of color on the wrong side of what you were doing at the DA's office. Is that correct? Meaning that they were often the accused and often wrongly accused or being punished more severely than they should have been for crimes for which they were accused.
Yeah, I mean, you see a good, as is kind of common knowledge at this point in our education about the criminal justice system, is that there's definitely more, you know, people of color and poor people who are affected by the criminal justice system.
Now, are there more people of color, in raw numbers or by percentage relative to their own population?
Percentage by their population.
Okay, I'm just curious. Okay, so
without any.
Yeah, so
big
now,
sight for you. That's yeah.
Well, that's okay. I mean, this is not a science show. but if people are interested, they can look it up. I'm sure that there's studies out there. So,
sure, that would be accurate.
Yeah. In the DA's office, were there a lot of assistant prosecutors who were people of color or particularly women of color?
You know, there were more than I guess if you just had asked me what it would look like, there was definitely more than you would suspect. But of course, we're talking about the Manhattan DA's office, New York City, and the classes that they hire were a higher percentage of women and probably seen more people of color in their hiring than historically. But at the same time, I mean, it didn't take, much to know that it's a very white male profession. And that's, who's at the top and who are most of the, decision makers, not only in the DA's office, but just, in the courts in general.
Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about your experience at the DA's, because let's, given what your assertion about the number of people of color who are the accused and the convicted, and you're there as a prosecutor prosecuting them. I mean, is there a conflict that you feel internally? I mean, is there a tension ever from that?
No, I don't think so. Because, I mean, I guess I can always, speaking for myself, like as a prosecutor, if I was prosecuting someone, I believe that and knew and had evidence to, show that they had committed whatever crime, that they were being charged with. So you don't, pick and choose who you prosecute based on race. But, I mean, there's definitely a lot of things to look at and take away from that. I mean, the power of the prosecutor is great.
Like how powerful? Can you move objects with your mind?
Almost. It is. It's really great. And I don't think that a lot of young people coming into that job realize how great of a power that is to take away somebody's liberty.
Like, can you throw
for
people,
significant periods of time?
Can you throw people in jail that, like, you just don't like? Let's say you have a bad breakup with a boyfriend or girlfriend. You can just, like, you know what? I'm going to send the cops to arrest this person.
No, you can't do that. However, my mother likes to, threaten small children that are giving her a hard time. She's like, my daughter's a prosecutor and she's on the phone right now. She's going to send you to jail. And the kids believe it.
Wow, that's cool.
Like, this is a wrong idea they're getting about how this works.
But it might keep them, I mean, as a parent now of a toddler, that actually is not a bad concept. But I mean, like, what other powers? You don't have, like, powers to control the elements or anything like that either.
No, but, some prosecutors think they do.
Oh, they're the ones who get into the movies, like with Harvey Keitel.
Exactly. They get all the good spots.
Yeah. And what types of crimes were you focused on, or did you have a specialty?
No, I was lucky enough to get to try all and prosecute all kinds of cases.
Like jaywalking? Did you do a jaywalking case?
No, I tried to focus my career on more serious things than jaywalking.
Like
never had tickets? A jaywalking case.
Parking tickets.
No, those don't even come to criminal court.
No, I know. All right, so tell us the kinds of things, or tell us some of your more memorable or significant cases. With it leaving out the names of the people, we don't have to, discuss that here, but just the types of cases.
For me, the whole thing that kind of even brought me into the law and being a prosecutor was being an advocate for victims. So the cases that were always most interesting to me were cases where, what we say, the victim cases versus, a drug case or, whatever else, a credit card case. I enjoyed working on and working with the people involved in cases, that oftentimes were the saddest cases where there was an assault or, a sex abuse or, something of that nature. But that's really, where I felt most passionate about my work. So
you would put away guys who went to prostitutes.
What was that?
You put away guys who went to prostitutes. I mean, just, this guy's in a loveless marriage. He just wants to have a little bit of affection. And you're like, you know what, buddy, you're going to jail.
Yep. Don't feel bad about that.
Wow, that's cold. That is cold. By the way, I don't think it's fair to say that credit card cases are victimless, because if you've ever had your credit card boosted and had
it is horrible.
Yeah.
And there are victims, but they're able to recover usually much better than people who other kinds of crimes.
Yes.
Violent crimes.
Yeah. Well, all right. Okay. So, but now, at some point, you... And by the way, did you enjoy your tenure there?
I did. It was a great job, great office to work for. I worked with really good people. I have to say, professionally and personally, it will be, an experience that will live with me, forever. I learned a tremendous amount about everything, myself, society, race, the criminal justice system. It was just, all in all. And then also just being a lawyer, being able to litigate and go to court and pick juries and go into the grand jury and have results, and also, do the right thing when there was a case that shouldn't be prosecuted, to, dismiss the case. And I guess it's the same, the power of the prosecutor. I mean, it was an awesome job in that way. And I'm really glad to have had that experience.
Yeah, so you mentioned that you learned a lot of different things about yourself and other things as well, but you mentioned that you learned stuff about race. Tell us what you learned about race working at the DA's office.
A lot, but I guess it was interesting working with law enforcement, because you work very closely with the police department and you are law enforcement as a prosecutor, and kind of seeing how people... turn things on and off when it comes to race, when they're in that position, and sort of things like implicit bias and good-meaning and well-meaning people sometimes not knowing the harm that they can cause to an individual or a community by the power that they have as being part of law enforcement. Also, just the work with the defense bar and how they do their job and how they see race as part of the work that they do in defending their clients. And, it was very intriguing kind of social experiment that goes on there.
Well, did it leave you feeling optimistic or pessimistic or any particular adjective about, people and their racial views and racism in America?
It made me feel like there is a lot of work to be done, that is going to take true effort amongst many people to, change where we're at. And kind of sad that it just, with all that's happened, we've had a lot of progress, but with all that's happened in this country, that we're still kind of where we are.
Right. I mean,
race and the criminal justice system.
Right. Well, look, I mean, obviously there's been huge strides in America on race. I mean, President Obama, I guess, is illustration one of that, because it's hard to imagine having a biracial or black president 50 years ago. On the other hand, we have Ferguson, we have the Eric Garner incident, we have what just happened at Oklahoma University with the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity, and on and on and on. And then all these news reports now of black men and young black men either being shot or being killed by white police officers. And I don't know all the details of each of those incidents, but it seems like it's a fairly ongoing large problem. On the other hand, we have a movie out now with Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart, which is a great mixing of the races.
Wow, you went there.
Yeah, I mean, I frankly think that sounds like a terrible movie, and I've not seen it, so I shouldn't cast aspersions, but just that combination doesn't strike me as the winning combo. I mean, 50 years ago...
I think all that said a lot of... I mean, it's a lot of good, too, right? Because all of these things have stayed in the media and stayed on people's minds. And I don't, I mean, obviously I'm still working very connected to the criminal justice system. So it's a part of my life, but I can't go to a party or a bar or, you know, a dinner without it coming up as part of the discussion in one way or another. And so I think that's great. And not these things are happening, but that it's, you know, we're continuing the conversation and people are questioning things and people are challenging, you know, our systems and asking for better and kind of holding the people in power, you know, holding their feet to the fire a bit.
Right, right. Dude, I want to get to what you're doing now for your career, but before we get there, I want to ask you a couple of more questions, more personal nature. I've heard a lot of biracial people mention that they get often asked, you know, what are you? Is that something that's happened to you quite a bit?
All the time.
And do you have a stock answer?
You know, I used to, and now I just say I don't answer that.
You just stand there silently staring.
I just say, you know, I'll actually just respond and say, you know, because I feel like, one, I'm just tired of the question. And then two, I don't understand it. I mean, I do. I get it. I mean, I feel like people really, most of the time, are asking that question because they're trying to figure out, they look at me and they're like, a lot of people think I'm Ethiopian or Somali, occasionally like Dominican or Latina in some way, and sometimes they think I'm Black, but they don't know and they can't fit me in a box. And I feel as if that question is, I need to know what box to fit you in so I can feel comfortable moving forward with how I can approach you, talk to you. Can I relate to you?
Do you say all that to them when you're, do you say, I think that you need to fit me in a box so you can be comfortable? I mean, that's a long answer.
No, but this is what has gone through my mind is years of being asked this over and over all the time, is, you know, why are, you know, I've had conversations with myself and with other people, you know, why are people feeling, because if you're the, you know, the white guy or the Jewish guy at the party, there are people walking like, what are you? Where are you from?
No
one's asking anyone else, why are you asking me this, you know? And so some of my own pulling apart of that question has been that. So in my mind, that's kind of where I'm at. So I'm just kind of like, I'm not gonna answer that. And some of these will just start guessing, you know, they don't accept it and they want to, you know, they're like, no, you have to tell me. it's a very strange thing to me.
May I be so bold as to suggest an answer? I think that you, from now on, if you're out in a social setting and someone says, what are you? You should say, I'm Alicia Keys' cousin. And
I'll try it. I'll let you know. Go.
And I think, you know, you bear enough of a resemblance to her, or she to you, you know, because we'll give you more props than she, so I don't know her, that people would believe it. And then you could just walk away. Just say, hey,
drop the mic.
That's right. Drop the mic. Boom. I'm done. And I'm out. SC out. So I try that. Does your husband get that question?
Does my husband get that question? I think he does sometimes, but he's a bit lighter than me and he has his head shaved. So a lot of people just assume he's Hispanic or Latino and I always tease him.
Does he speak Spanish?
But, you know. No.
So you can't pull it off at all?
No.
Because they're like, what are you? And he's like, I don't speak the Spanish. And that's it. And so he's outed himself as just an American Black person or biracial person.
Is he what?
Then he's just outed himself as an American or biracial person.
Right. It's all over then. I think he gets the question. Probably not as much as me, but I think he gets it. Sometimes, yeah.
I also suggest that he try the same, or even he should go one step further and just adopt the persona of Common. And so if someone says, what are you? He should say, Common doesn't answer questions. like the way celebrities talk.
I'll suggest that to
you. You know, the way celebrities don't talk about themselves in the third person.
Right.
Yeah, you say Comet doesn't answer questions. Comet's a vegetarian. Comet doesn't take in toxins, you know. Okay. So let's get back to your work, because we're coming to the end of the hour, and I want to get to what you're doing now. So you left the DA's office but remained in the criminal justice arena. And let's tell people what you're doing now.
Sure. So now I work for what's called the National Network for Safe Communities, which is part of John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And it's a really kind of unique place and position and an opportunity for me to have come from being a prosecutor to now kind of using that background and experience to kind of work on issues of kind of reform and repair of the broken parts of the criminal justice system.
And what parts are broken? I mean, is it that people of color are more frequently incarcerated and brought into courts, or is what exactly is broken?
Well, I mean, wow. big question.
Is it because DAs use their power for bad by moving objects and changing the elements? I mean, tell us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, they're creating those waves that was in that movie.
Yeah. So tell us what are the big things that are broken?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with relationships that need to be worked on between communities and, I guess, you know, I'll say law enforcement generally, but police, who are usually the, you know, the primary piece, part of law enforcement that are interfacing with communities. You know, one of the kind of key principles that we work from at the National Network is first do no harm, and knowing that the criminal justice system can be strong medicine. You know, it can help, or if it's applied in the wrong way, if it's, you know, too aggressive, if it's disrespectful policing, that those things can ultimately really hurt individuals and communities. And so looking at ways to kind of build back those relationships between law enforcement, neighborhoods, communities where they work is kind of the first step to repairing, you know, some of those things that, you know, say are broken, because there has been a historic, you know, kind of issue of race with law enforcement in this country, right? When you look back, you know, throughout history, the way that, you know, how this country started and how it's gone from there, that race has always been an issue.
Yeah.
Connected to law enforcement, and law enforcement, you know, people talk about, you know, Jim Crow and when there's lynchings and law enforcement often being intertwined in all of these this racist history that's gone on.
So
just to get really deep at the end here, you asked me this big question, what's wrong? You know?
Well, so let me ask you this. I mean, do you think that as you look back now, at the, you know, at your still relatively young age, because you're not right out of college, but you're still a young woman, certainly compared to me, certainly. Do you think, as you look back, that you can see a clear line or a clear narrative arc from who you are, you know, a biracial woman raised in an all-white community who was adopted, to the point you're at now? I mean, was it almost predestined that you'd wind up doing what you're doing because of your background and your sensitivity to being an outsider and being perhaps the object of unfair prejudices?
I think you could, you could draw that. I mean, I think a lot of part, you know, that plays into that is my parents, that raised me, have been advocates, in many ways in their careers for, you know, disenfranchised, marginalized people and communities, but also kind of, yeah, having the experience of feeling, you know, as an outsider. But also I think kind of the, I don't know how you say, straddling of two worlds sometimes, being a biracial person and that working to great benefit, you know, being a prosecutor, being, you know, an advocate, being kind of working in the work that I've done, that you can, I don't know, understand, relate, connect. You don't, and sometimes it gets complicated because people are, you know, you're not allegiant enough to, I don't have enough allegiance to one side, or you're not black enough, you're not white enough. You, but, yeah, I think that I think all of those things that have happened from, you know, zero to now have definitely impressed upon and created that, I guess, arc, as you say, to bring me where I am now.
Yeah, yeah, which is at a very high-paying nonprofit sector job.
You don't get rich saving the world.
No, not unless you're a hedge fund manager who gives money to charity. Okay, well, I think we've come to the end of the hour. Now, ordinarily, at this portion of the show, I would call this the shameless plug portion of the show, and I have a lot of artists and content creators, quote-unquote, who want to come on and plug their books and their whatever, their music and their paintings and so forth and so on, and you're an artist of social consciousness, so it's not like you have your own personal website or your YouTube page that you're going to be promoting. But, you know, to the extent that you want to promote the National Network, I mean, and feel comfortable doing that, we'd love to have you do that and to give people the website information and, you know, how they can contribute or participate if that's feasible. So you have the floor. Go ahead.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, I would encourage your listeners to check out the National Network for Safe Communities. The website is nnscommunities.org. And, you know, we're doing some really exciting and interesting things there that I think would be great if more people learned about and asked questions about and got engaged in. We're about to kick off a huge project with a grant from the Department of Justice, and we're going to be working on procedural justice and implicit bias and racial reconciliation over the next few years intensively with police departments, communities around the country. And, you know, I would just encourage people to, you know, stay conscious, stay engaged, and learning about, you know, the criminal justice system and how it affects you and your life and your community, because it's really, I think people don't get connected to it until something bad happens. And I think if more people paid attention along the way, we it would help us get to a better place.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, that's good. So people should definitely take Shireen up on that offer and that invitation to get engaged and to seek out the National Network. And finally, before I let you go, so if people want to get discounted tickets to the next Alicia Keys or Common concert, how do they get a hold of you?
He's going to kill you with this Common business.
Wow.
You know what? I don't know. I'll tell them to visit your website and start making requests.
Okay. Yeah. Right. If the listeners want to reach out to me, I can bundle those requests and I'll reach out to Alicia and see what she says, or at least reach out to Shireen, who's Alicia's cousin, and that's actually not true.
Another biracial person, you know, Alicia Keys. We all look the same.
Well, there is a club, right? I mean, this is my dream is that when my son gets a little older, I'm going to take him to the meetings, and we'll say hello to Derek Jeter and President Obama and Blake Griffin and Boris Kodjo and you and your husband and Alicia Keys and Halle Berry. And that we'll take a big group photo, and I'll get it autographed by everybody.
That exactly. He's got a secret card now to
he
be
does,
in the club.
Right? Does that really, those meetings, do they actually happen?
Yeah, of course. Don't tell anybody, though.
Well, we've just told my listenership, which is vast. I mean, I have perhaps more listeners than Howard Stern at this point.
It's out there now.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, listen, Shireen, I'm going to let you go. I thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was a lot of fun. I hope you had a good time.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, everyone, that was Shireen Crawford. And, again, the National Network, NNS, and National Network, NNScommunities.org, correct?
Right.
Okay. Thanks so much, Shireen.
Thank you. Take care.
Well, that about wraps it up for this episode of the Multiracial Family Man Podcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm Alex Barnett. You can reach me on the web at alexbarnettcomic.com, on Facebook at facebook.com/alexbarnettcomic, on Twitter at @barnettcomic. Thank you again for joining us. And now we're going to say goodbye. Say goodbye to everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.